This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, December 6, 2010. I'm Kyle Kellums. There are changes taking place at City Hall in Rogers. Longtime Mayor Steve Womack is moving to Washington, D.C. after he won the 3rd District Congressional seat, formerly held by U.S. Senator-elect John Bozeman. The new mayor of Rogers, Greg Hines, will be sworn in January 1st. He won a runoff election for the race 2 weeks ago. Since then, he's been preparing for his new job while preparing his successor at his old job, Director of Public Safety for Benton County. The mayor-elect is not taking on a new job blindly. He served for 10 years on the Rogers City Council. Still, he told us in an interview Friday afternoon that the past 2 weeks have been busy.
Well, if I thought I wasn't getting any sleep during the election process, I've gone back to work in my full-time position at the county, and I started working through the transitional process with Mayor Womack. So I've been meeting with department heads, trying to plug a few in a day. I have made an announcement yesterday about my executive assistant, who will come on board Monday, the 6th. And so we're just trying to prepare for the transition process, which, of course, there's one going to take, the transition of leadership is taking place at the county as well. So I feel an obligation to help make sure that process is as smooth as what I'm experiencing in Rogers.
And just as you have someone following you on the county level, you are following the soon-to-be former Mayor Womack, who has himself something he's transitioning to. How much time have you been able to spend with him?
Well, Mayor Womack and I have spent several hours together the day after the election. My wife and I spent about an hour and a half with the mayor, talking about various issues that he felt were important to pass along to us on more of a personal level than an organizational level or dealing with the city. And since that time, I have spent a couple of hours with him at different times to discuss specific issues that he feels compelled and important to pass along with regard to city functions.
You will take that oath of office on January 1st, correct?
Yes.
And then you are the mayor of Rogers. What is at the top of your list, or what is pretty apparent on your radar for the city in 2011?
Sure. Well, the first thing is obviously to continue to establish, a rapport. I mean, I know most of the department heads. I've been on the council for 12 years, and so, these aren't new faces, nor are they new processes with the city. But it's going to be important for me to establish that rapport with all those department heads. And then the most important thing about 2011 is the bond issue, without a doubt. I mean, that is vitally important for the future of Rogers for many, many years to come. So, I'm going from one campaign to another, as it would turn out.
And I guess then you would consider communication of the importance of the bond issue to voters a key component of the first few months.
Absolutely. I mean, there's still some question, I guess, with issue two. It will be going to the Supreme Court. I feel pretty confident the Supreme Court's not going to overturn what the voters found overwhelmingly to be a good amendment. So we will proceed forward planning our bond issue election for the spring of 2011. And, the city has grown so much over the years, and it's not just good enough anymore to say, this is a good thing and you ought to support it. I think, voters expect to have the opportunity to vet our process, to vet, what we see is important to the city. This has been an ongoing process to get these projects in place. But you're talking about a $130 million bond issue that's debt serviced with a 1 cent sales tax, which is currently on the books. It will, it's important that we are able to tell them it's no new taxes. It would be an extending a 1 cent sales tax to debt service those bonds. But $130 million is a lot of money, and it resonates into what is the future face of Rogers.
Your mayoral colleagues from the other larger cities in Northwest Arkansas have been there for a while. Have you had a chance to talk with Mayor Jordan or Mayor McCaslin or any of the other mayors in Northwest Arkansas?
Yes, I have spoken with I have spoken with Mayor McCaslin, Mayor Fayetteville, Sprouse. I mean, I visited with all three of them today. Earlier, met with the new mayor of Lowell at a chamber function. So, you know, I have a relationship established with Mayor McCaslin and Mayor Sprouse as I've, you know, throughout the years of serving in public in a public role. So, but it was nice to get to meet Mayor Jordan in Fayetteville, and I look forward to working with all of them on a regional basis.
Of course, you share the border with Bentonville, which we now know Crystal Bridges will open in November of 2011, and the announcement last week that there would be the 2,200-seat venue in Bentonville. Do you see Rogers experiencing some change because of these large new arts and culture venues that are in the town next to you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, would I like to have had Crystal Bridges in Rogers? Well, sure. Would I like to have a 2,200-seat Walt Nurse Center in Rogers? Absolutely. But at the end of the day, you know, Bentonville will succeed. We will also succeed as a result of this. I mean, Rogers is the retail base. We have, you know, a lot of the hotels and obviously the restaurant base. So we see this as a great opportunity for the region and not just specifically for the cities individually. So I'm excited about that. We, you know, we'll have a strategic plan in place to try to leverage and maximize the opportunities that those two venues present to the city. And you know, that what a great thing when you see that kind of private and philanthropic investment in communities.
And finally, as you mentioned, you've been on the Rogers City Council for some time. The campaign went for a while, but has there been anything that has surprised you since you were elected mayor of Rogers in the past couple of weeks?
You know, no, not really. I mean, you know, you said it. I've been around this process for over a decade, and really feel like I've tried to prepare myself to be, you know, to accept this role that the citizens have given me, and I'm just excited and ready to get to work.
Mayor-elect Greg Hines, thank you so much for your time.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me, Kyle.
Greg Hines is the mayor-elect for the city of Rogers. He'll be sworn into office next month. He spoke to us by phone Friday afternoon. This is Ozarks at Large. The city of Fayetteville takes great pride in its trees, and last month, a plan began to put more trees in the city. Ozarks at Large's Ithi Egnihotri-Madolker has this story.
By the end of this year, 241 new trees will be planted across the different subdivisions of the city of Fayetteville. Having started in November, the planting project is a part of the city's Green Streets initiative to plant more trees along the streets of Fayetteville. Greg Howe, urban forester for the city, says these trees were originally to be mitigation trees for the ones removed from the subdivisions when they were being built by the developer.
It wouldn't be a good idea to plant those trees at that time because when all the construction crews came in to build the homes, they would probably accidentally run over some of the trees or back into them by mistake or something like that might happen to them. So we give the option of the developer to plant the trees either off-site at another location that they own or to pay money in lieu of planting the trees into what we call our tree escrow fund. And that money that these companies put into the tree escrow fund is something the city holds on to. And then when those subdivisions are built out, the city comes back in and either through city crews or through a contractor plants these trees in the right-of-way so that these subdivisions now will have street trees and be able to have some shading effects from those street trees and some oxygen being produced from those street trees and just aesthetically pleasing things that, you know, the street trees add to a neighborhood.
The trees are being planted by All Around Landscaping Incorporated of Springdale. Greg says even though Fayetteville may seem like a fairly green city, a satellite study conducted in 2002 by American Forests, a nonprofit conservation organization, revealed the city is having only 27% canopy cover, whereas the recommended percentage is 40%.
Well, when you take the city as a whole and you figure all the old agricultural lands that were cleared of forests and the areas that have been, you know, are now parking lots and buildings, and you add all that into it, you start realizing that while it looks like we have a lot of trees, we really don't. It makes the city warmer. It'll be 5 to 7 degrees warmer than the surrounding lands, the rural lands that are around it. So what happens is if you can come in and you can put in trees on the streets and put trees in the parking lots and you can put them to shade the buildings, and then if you can add green roofs to the top of the buildings, you can cut down on what's called that heat island effect, is where you get all of this hardscaping that radiates heat from the sun that it's absorbed all day back into the atmosphere and increases the heat of the city.
Greg says the other benefit of lining city streets with trees is adding height over time to the roadway. As the trees get larger and taller, they calm people's emotions, thereby reducing instances of road rage. Trees also extend the road to peripheral vision, which then helps in slowing drivers down. Greg says research being conducted by the University of Washington shows many psychological benefits to planting trees.
There is research out there now that says that children who have views of trees from their school's classrooms are more attentive and will do better in school than those that don't. There is research out there that suggests that domestic violence is reduced in poor apartment complexes or other places like that where there are trees surrounding that apartment complex or that area than where there aren't. We're also seeing research now that will say that actually crime is reduced in areas where there are trees, mature trees, than areas that don't have mature trees. For right now, everything psychologically is proving to be a vast benefit, one we don't realize it's there, but it is there.
The trees are being planted in 9 subdivisions of the city. According to Greg, as an urban forester, an important part of his job is making sure diverse tree species are planted throughout the city.
And so anytime that I try and do one of these street projects, I usually try to introduce 3 species, at least. Might be more, but at least 3. And 2 of those will be hardwoods, something like a maple and an oak. And the other one will be an evergreen, such as a shortleaf pine or a loblolly pine, just to try and give some green texture during the winter time. So we have 1 evergreen. And this year we had things like bur oak, pin oak, Schumard oak, red maples. We used the cultivar Autumn Flame and Red Sunset. We used sugar maples, shortleaf pine. We did get some black gums. We got some black walnuts. We got some Kentucky coffee trees. And so there's just this wide variety of trees, species in the different locations. Not every place had the same type of tree.
An earlier tree planting project planted 230 trees along the creeks, parks, and trails of Fayetteville in the months of July and August. The project, funded by the Arkansas Forestry Commission, was an effort to replace trees damaged during the ice storm of January 2009. According to Greg, fall, early winter is the best time to plant trees.
Well, in using what we call ball and burlap trees, these are trees that are growing out in a field in the nursery. And then they bring a tree spade in and they cut the roots off the tree when they dig it up. So about 90% of the roots are actually lost when you dig this tree up. When you do that any other time of year, you always have the problem of it being too hot or not enough rainfall for this tree to get in the ground and start growing new roots so that it can, you know, pick up water and pick up nutrients and stuff like that. So the fall actually represents the best time. In fall, late fall and early winter is the best time to plant because the tree gets in the ground. The root system, even though the tree may be dormant, it may have dropped all its leaves, the root system is still alive, it's still active, and until the ground actually freezes, that root system will continue to grow.
Planting trees under the current project is estimated to be complete by December 15th. However, the project will be considered done only after a 30-day period during which the contractor will ensure proper maintenance of the planted trees. For Ozarks at Large, this is Iti Agnihotri Mudholkar.
Some health news from the state capitol this morning. Health officials say the flu season is starting earlier than they expected. 4 counties in the state, none in our listening area, have already reported mild flu activity. The Arkansas Department of Health spokesman Ed Barham says only one of the cases resembled the swine flu.
We now had seven cases that we are showing positive results for, and those are lab tests that are done here at the public health lab. Those are different from the tests that are done in a doctor's office. The rapid tests are not the same thing. Once we have a PCR test, we know for sure that's the influenza, and we know what type.
Ed Barham says the cases so far have been found in Craighead, Faulkner, Randolph, in Saline counties. A researcher at the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences has turned up a possible trigger for adult onset obesity. Gwen Childs, chair of the UAMS Neurobiology Department, published her findings in the January edition of the journal Endocrinology. She found that removing the receptor for the hormone leptin from growth hormone cells caused weight gain in mice. Child says a $1.7 million federal grant will fund further testing.
We're going to look at their activity levels, whether or not they sleep normally, and eventually we may be monitoring liver enzymes and other factors that would affect metabolism. We're going to look at each aspect to see if we can get at the mechanism why these animals are becoming obese.
Child says it's too early to say whether a similar link might be found in human subjects, but the research suggests avenues for further study toward an eventual breakthrough in preventing obesity. And ahead on this edition of Ozarks at Large, a new report on how the wealthiest Americans give. Last week, one of the leading experts on that report was in Fayetteville, and we'll hear our conversation with Claire Costello, the National Foundation Executive for Philanthropic Management at Bank of America, Merrill Lynch. And right after Earth and Sky, the Ozarks Philharmonic Youth Orchestra tunes up for a weekend performance in Bentonville. That's ahead on Ozarks at Large. This is a Monday edition of Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. Aspiring young classical musicians have found remarkable opportunities in the Ozarks Philharmonic Youth Orchestras. The 45-member symphony is conducted by Myron Flippin. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich attended their recent concert rehearsal and provides us their story.
My name is Myron Flippin, and I am the music director for the Ozarks Philharmonic Youth Orchestras.
By day, Myron Flippin's a freelance professional conductor, orchestral vocal soloist, and master class teacher. He has advanced degrees in cello and voice and a doctorate in orchestral conducting. He's performed and conducted in Europe before settling in the Ozarks. He was co-principal cellist with the North Arkansas Symphony. In May 2006, he was appointed conductor of the Ozarks Chorale, a community choir based in Northwest Arkansas. He served as music director of the North Arkansas Symphony Youth Orchestras until 2008. His last big guest appearance was as guest conductor of the New England Symphonic Ensemble in a performance of Mozart's Coronation Mass in C, Opus 317, with a 155-voice choir and four world-class soloists at Carnegie Hall in New York City. He's a passionate mentor for classical musicians from all backgrounds and ages, and especially enjoys working with young people.
The Ozarks Philharmonic Youth Orchestras began after the demise of the North Arkansas Symphony. We were a part of the North Arkansas Symphony as a youth orchestra, and some parents were concerned that because they had canceled the next season for the symphony, that we would not have a season. So they formed their own 501c3 organization. And after my contract had expired, they asked me to be their music director. So that was July of 08. So this is our third season. And I had been with the North Arkansas Symphony Youth Orchestra since 2000. So I've been doing this for 11 years now. Well, to see kids grow and, you know, they come in scared, they're not sure they can play in a symphony orchestra or something because not too many school programs have symphony orchestras. We have private school students, we have homeschool students, and so a lot of them, it's a totally new experience, and to watch them come in and grow and mature as players and as people from, you know, when I first started in 2000, I had some 6 and 7 year olds who are now in college playing, and I've seen them come through the program and advance, and it's very satisfying. Yes, membership is by audition. We usually have auditions in August for the next year. But we take anyone. I just did an audition a few moments ago. That's probably why you couldn't find me. Someone who's expressed an interest and had heard about one of her friends was playing, and so she came and joined us. So I just auditioned her, and we have a new player today. But yes, you may audition any time, but we generally try to do it either both in May and in August, but our main auditions are in August. We are a 501c3 organization, so we do charge a tuition fee of $150 per semester, which is about half to a third of what a Metropolitan Youth Orchestra charges. Kansas City has $700 or $800 for a year, and you know, so we try to keep it small town, but yet because of our metropolitan area with 450,000 people, we are a city in a metropolitan area where we can have a youth orchestra. And that is our goal, is to build a youth orchestra program equal to St. Louis, Kansas City, Oklahoma City, Dallas, whatever. But we get donations from people of the community. We can apply for grants through the NEA and that sort of thing. We were not eligible for those for the first 3 years because you have to be in existence with your present name for 3 years before you can apply for an NEA grant. But this year we will be eligible for that. We have fundraisers. In the past, we've sold candy, poinsettias. We have a silent auction coming up at our next concert. So anything we can do to raise money to buy music and keep things going. We have four ensembles, three string groups, basically beginning, intermediate, and advanced, and then we have one full complete symphony orchestra.
Students come from 17 public schools, as well as home and charter schools, traveling down from Missouri and across Northwest Arkansas. Classes meet weekly in the music lab at Burns Hall, courtesy Northwest Arkansas Community College, and they perform publicly several times a year.
Mostly two performances, one in December and one in May, but it broadens their horizon. What the schools do is magnificent. They teach them how to play in an orchestra, but this just takes it to the next step up from that, which they may not be able to do because of time constraints or budget restraints, whereas the advanced student gets an opportunity to come and play with us and excel in their own way.
Myron allows students to first freely play a movement without any specific direction so he can assess issues. Under his baton, the musicians refine tempo, key, and harmony. After about 45 minutes of direction, Mendelssohn's Symphony No. 5, the second movement, sounds like this. The 40 or so students reflect all kinds of backgrounds, ages, and interests, yet everyone's utterly serious about performing in this symphony. Not only do most travel long distances to attend the weekly two-hour practice, they must also practice at home. During a 10-minute break, everyone grabs a drink and a snack.
I'm Indigo Fisher, I'm 13, and I'm in 8th grade, and I play the flute for the youth symphony. And I think this is a great learning experience, and I've learned a whole bunch on how to learn and how to play with a big group of instruments.
Are you making fast progress, slow progress?
I am making a lot of fast progress, and I'm practicing on my own, and it's really blending in well with the orchestra as we get together on the practices. So.
My name is Mary Bartell. I'm 14. I play the viola. I'm a freshman in high school. And playing in the orchestra is really amazing. It's really fun, and it's a great time, you know, playing together with other people and getting to play exciting music that just, it's amazing.
I'm Jamie Porsche, and I'm 17, a senior in high school, and I play the flute. And for me, being in the symphony has really, I've been in this symphony since 10th grade. So yeah, I've matured so much as a player. And it's been, for a flautist or any woodwind really, it's almost like being a soloist, because you're usually, there's one or two instruments on your part. So it's helped me develop lots of courage and musicality, and it's been a great experience.
Even before Myron ends the break, most of the students have returned to their seats to practice. They next perform the finale of Beethoven's Egmont Overture. Amazing and very dedicated musicians will also tackle symphonic dances from Fiddler on the Roof and some Shostakovich. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
The Ozarks Philharmonic Youth Orchestra presents their winter concert Sunday at 2:30 at Old High Middle School Auditorium in Bentonville. If you'd like more information or tickets, opyo.org. That's opyo.org.
I got rhythm, I got music, I got my man, who could ask for anything more?
American lyricist Ira Gershwin was born on this date in 1896 in Manhattan, New York. The musician collaborated with his younger brother George Gershwin on more than 20 Broadway musicals and motion pictures until George's death in 1937. Ira was born on New York's Lower East Side to Russian Jewish immigrant parents. Early on, he showed literary talent and attended City College of New York for 2 years. After that, he did odd jobs until his brother, already becoming known as a composer and musician, asked him to write lyrics. Their first song of collaboration was The Real American Folk Song, which appeared in Ladies First in 1918. During the early years, Ira Gershwin used a pseudonym, Arthur Francis, in order not to capitalize on his brother's reputation. Over the years, he wrote many lyrics for such Gershwin songs as The Man I Love, I Got Rhythm, Embraceable You, A Foggy Day, and Fascinating Rhythm. He also prepared the lyrics for Porgy and Bess with such songs as Summertime, I Got Plenty of Nuttin', and It Ain't Necessarily So. His later credits include Long Ago and Far Away with Jerome Kern, and The Man That Got Away with Harold Arlen, written for Judy Garland. He collected all the lyrics of his best-known songs and wrote commentaries on each in the 1959 book Lyrics on several occasions. Ira Gershwin continued writing into the last year of his life, rewriting lyrics for Gershwin tunes used in the musical My One and Only. Antiquities collector Edwin Curtis died of a sudden heart attack in Nashville, Tennessee, on this date in 1880. Curtis was a non-professional field man who excavated archaeological sites in Arkansas. He is credited by Arkansas archaeologists with making the first scientific archaeological excavation in the state. Army engineers completed construction of the Washington Monument on this date in 1884. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
It's Monday, December 6th, 2010. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me is Becca Bacon-Martin. She is the editor of What's Up in Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Okay, Kyle, I have a tradition.
And that is?
I try to work up to ho, ho, ho before Christmas.
Are you there?
No, I'm at one ho.
Oh, okay.
How's your ho level?
Wow. I don't know how to answer that. You know what? I am not a Scrooge. I'm not Bah Humbug. But I like to wait. I like to, you know, maybe not till December 18th or 19th, but there has been Christmas music at our house already.
See,
so I'm kind of seasonal.
If you start with one, you work your way up.
Yes.
If you need to go find your first of your ho-ho-hos, 6:45 tonight, the Rogers Christmas Parade.
Oh, and you know what? I like a nighttime Christmas parade.
And they have some, in the past, they've had some really cool floats. Really interesting. They had a huge Grinch.
Yeah.
So it starts at 5th and Poplar, goes to 1st and Poplar, north on 1st, to Walnut. You can find out more about it at 936-5487.
The great thing about a parade, though, is you don't have to follow it the whole way. Just find something along the route and then just plan yourself.
Find a warm spot.
Right.
And tonight, the members of the University of Arkansas at Fort Smith Music Department will play a warm-up concert at 7 at the Stubblefield Center on campus. After the show, everyone will depart for the campus green, where a light display will be illuminated.
Yeah.
And it's free.
Yes. All right. Becca Bacon-Martin is the editor of What's Up, found in Northwest Arkansas newspapers.
Everybody's an expert on their own lives. And on Talk of the Nation, we ask you to share your stories.
These techniques were used on me when I went through resistance training, sleep deprivation, putting bags over our heads.
I'm Neil Conan. Real stories from real people about real issues that matter to you. Join us. Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation this afternoon at 1 o'clock, right after this edition of Ozarks at Large. Last week, a national report on philanthropy practices of the country's wealthiest households was released. The 2010 Bank of America Merrill Lynch study of high net worth philanthropy asked thousands of people across the country, those in a higher income bracket, about their decisions to give to nonprofit causes and organizations. For the purpose of the study, high net worth was defined as households with an annual income of $200,000 or more, or a net worth of more than $1 million. The 2010 report shows that high net worth households contributed as much to charities in 2009 as they did in the most recent studies for the years of 2005 and 2007. But certain types of nonprofits benefited more than others. The day the report was released, one of the best experts on the study happened to be in Fayetteville. Claire Costello is the National Foundation Executive for Philanthropic Management at Bank of America Merrill Lynch. She was on the University of Arkansas campus to talk to the board of the University of Arkansas Foundation. After that meeting, she sat down in a conference room in the Reynolds Center for Enterprise Development on the UA campus to talk to me about the report, a report that shows a majority of high net worth income households do give to nonprofit causes.
98% of all high net worth individuals give, so virtually all. And this is very significant. By the way, that compares to about 64.65% of the general population. And the reason why this is such an important number and that this segment of our society and this swath of donors are so important is that they are singularly responsible for more than half of all giving in the United States. That includes corporate grant making, et cetera. They are responsible for about two-thirds of all individual grant making and, again, more than half of all grant making in the United States. So their behaviors, their motivations, their giving patterns really are of great interest to nonprofit organizations to inform their practices, to advisors who help support these donors and their wealth structuring, as well as to donors themselves who can really engage in some peer-to-peer learning based on the trends and the findings of the study.
The study, at times, it's a 75-page study, at times refers back to figures gleaned since 2005. One thing I found interesting is in the 2010 study, there are some subsets of nonprofits who saw an increase in philanthropic giving from the high net households, including arts and entertainment, the environment, and international causes.
That's true. And at risk of sounding cynical or glib, they could have only gone up based on some of the other the past giving levels. But yes, they did increase. What we find is that the high net worth individuals give first and foremost to their giving vehicles. By that I mean their private foundation, their donor advised fund, their charitable trusts, etc., from which of course they ultimately then give to beneficiaries. Secondly, they give to education. While educational giving drops significantly, it nonetheless is the second most frequently donated to area. And then thirdly, religion. Again, this differs from the general population, which gives first to religion, then to combination funds such as the United Way, and then to basic needs, you know, housing, shelter, and whatnot. And what we found was that this year, the giving to their giving vehicles went up about 21%. And what we think that's about is that donors are becoming increasingly more sophisticated. There are several data points in the study that indicate that. And it is part of that overall growth and sophistication. They're becoming structured in their giving. It also reflects the fact that we're in the midst of the largest intergenerational transfer of wealth ever seen in the United States and in the post-industrialized world. And that those funds that are coming like a freight train are also being structured in a way that allows for greater philanthropic giving. So we see an increase of almost 21% of giving to private foundations, donor advised funds, and other charitable vehicles. Secondly, giving to education declined by more than half. Giving to health organizations declined precipitously as well, and giving to religion dropped about 43.4%. And as you mentioned, yes, giving to the arts, giving to the environment and animal welfare, and giving to international causes went up. One of the explanations we put forth for why there was such a significant drop in giving to education and healthcare institutions is because those organizations tend to run capital campaigns. And anecdotally, we know that these organizations either have refrained from running those campaigns, run them at lower levels, and or donors have just given to them at lower levels. So focusing more on the short-term needs and the acute needs that were brought about by the financial downturn.
When you look at the reason to give, number one, 81.2% give back to community. And shortly after that is moved at how a gift can make a difference.
Clearly altruism leads the pack, and clearly the want to make a difference and have an impact are very important drivers for giving and for the giving impulse. It's often a misconception that tax drivers are the reason for giving, and time again, tax drivers are way down on the list. It's often been said that tax drivers will get you in the room, but they will not keep, get you in the door, but will not keep you in the room. Tax drivers are a much bigger factor in how to organize your giving, whether to use a private foundation, for example, or a donor advised fund. But yes, the more altruistic motivations clearly prevail in terms of why people become engaged in their giving.
You mentioned that tax drivers get you in the room. Tax drivers are what gets a lot of the gifts given, because a majority said that if there weren't income tax incentives, they probably wouldn't give as much.
Yeah, this is the first time we've seen this. There's much greater sensitivity and tenderness in this version of the study than there have been in the 2007 or the 2005, when the impact of tax policy was reported to be very little. In other words, changes in income tax deduction levels and or changes in the estate tax did not seem to have a wide or deep effect on giving patterns in the past. In the current study, that's not so true. In the current study, we're seeing a greater influence of potential changes in the tax policy on both the estate tax level and the income tax level, and how they would influence giving. And I think the reason we're seeing that is because there's a lot of chatter coming from Washington about the changes, which contribute to uncertainty overall. And what we're seeing in the list of factors as to why folks are giving this year, financial insecurity is no surprise, number two. It rose from the past study in 2007 from the fifth slot to the number two factor as influencing why people give. And uncertain tax policy certainly contributes to financial insecurity and uncertainty. And so we think those all tie in together. So we're not surprised at what people forecast, and I think it's important to remember that it is a forecast, what people forecast about the influence of their changes in tax policy on their giving levels. We won't really know until those tax policies do in fact change, if they do, and then looking back what the influence of that might be. And they will have to really be careful in subsequent research to establish a causal relationship there and not a correlational one. But yes, there is a heightened tenderness, if you will, around the tax question and how it might impact giving levels, both the income tax deduction and the estate tax deduction.
Flip this around. We've been talking about the people who make the philanthropic gifts. Thinking now of someone who might be asking for a philanthropic gift from someone that was in this survey. Number one reason someone stopped giving, they were solicited too much. It seems like there's a fine balance in this world.
There is, and you know, there really are a lot of demands on nonprofit organizations. Let me first back up and say that we did ask, you know, whether or not people stopped giving to organizations over the past 2009 giving year, and if so, how many? And I think it's heartening to be able to say people continued to give to the same number of organizations that they'd given to in the past. And in other words, they didn't stop giving to any more organizations than they had stopped giving to in 2007. And what that says is, while they may have been giving at lower levels in terms of average gift size, they nonetheless stood by, remained committed, and were steadfast in their support of the organizations that they care about. Now, that said, for those who did stop giving, yes, you're right to observe that the number one reason was because they were solicited either too frequently or at inappropriate amounts. We believe that this is attributable to the fact that either nonprofit organizations feeling fiscally constrained did, in fact, over-solicit by way of frequency and or amount, and or donors feeling their own fiscal constraints perhaps may have been more sensitive to the asks than they had been in the past. But nonetheless, for whatever reason, yes, they reported that they did stop giving because of the frequency or the inappropriateness of the solicitations that they received. The second on the list as to why they stopped giving was the fact that they decided to support other causes. Third was that their household circumstances changed, and I think it's important to note that that is in only third place and not first place, because change in household circumstances, of course, encompasses losing your job, losing a household income in the case where there were more than one, and things of that sort. And those factors did not prevail as the number one reason as to why folks stopped giving to organizations.
I imagine it would be anecdotal knowledge, if there's any knowledge at all, but any idea if the Bill Gates and Warren Buffett billionaires sort of give half or more of the wealth away before they die or after they die, if that has any influence, any sort of trickle-down influence?
It is anecdotal, but the answer is absolutely yes. Not only in the actual fact that they've enlisted their wealthy peers in the act and practice of giving, but we see generally a greater mainstreaming of giving. I mean, if you look at all of the mainstream magazines from you know, Business Week to Town and Country, I mean, they all have at least one feature donated to or dedicated to philanthropy every year. The Wall Street Journal and the New York Times have a giving section. You know, the idea of giving while living is much more prominent. The notion of engaging in giving with your subsequent generations, or being able to share in the joys and the rewards and the fulfillment that comes from giving and seeing all that your giving accomplishes. And again, the intergenerational transfer of wealth, that's really affording a greater opportunity with the greater the resources available to give. And I think, you know, the fact that folks are living longer gives us a greater opportunity to share values and experiences across generational lines. And I think that's also an important factor as well. So there are many, many things that contribute to the fact that people are getting more engaged. And I think the volunteer statistics from this year's study really, you know, affirm that, where it shows that an extraordinary number of high net worth individuals volunteer, and indeed volunteering went up among this segment by 4%. And not only are more volunteering, but more volunteering more hours, with the highest category volunteering more than 200 hours a year. So a very significant amount of engagement and sharing of time and talent, not just dollars. So I think, you know, we are seeing a greater emphasis on giving. And I think also the times warrant it. We've seen some real crises from arts institutions that have had to sell out their endowments to stay alive, to obviously food pantries and homeless shelters. And I think when the needs in your communities are that acute, it's really hard to not be thoughtful and responsive. And we do know from the study that the vast majority of giving is local, with, you know, only a combined 30% going to national and international organizations, with the bulk staying local. And I think that's also significant in terms of people being locally engaged and focused on what matters most to them.
A large number said if they did give to some sort of disaster relief, that did not alter in any way giving to their usual causes.
Yeah, another heartening statistic. We had not asked this previously, but we did ask who gave to disaster relief, and we learned that 85, or perhaps 83, I'm sorry not to know that off, 83% of high net worth households did give to disaster relief, and of those, 92% gave to disasters, to natural disasters, above and beyond their already planned and budgeted for giving. So there was not a trade-off when it came to funding disaster relief.
Northwest Arkansas is a region that has grown tremendously over the last 20, 25 years. The number of nonprofits, the number of people seeking philanthropic gifts has increased tenfold over the past couple of decades. Is there a danger of fatigue of being asked when the number of askers, questioners, continues to grow?
There's always a risk of that. And I think that the key is really for those seeking funds, that is to say, those that are appealing to donors, to really make sure that you are conveying your message, that you are really demonstrating in tangible terms how you are accomplishing your mission, how you're going about doing that. Make sure that transparency is really, part of your story. And so the notion that a donor can gain access to and become familiar with your organization through volunteerism, where we see a direct correlation between greater gift size and gift frequency with volunteerism. So creating opportunities to differentiate yourself, to demonstrate, to communicate how you are accomplishing your mission. And thus will be really keen to focus on who the donor is as an individual, what they care about, rather than what it is that you need for your organization. If you start with the donor and become very donor-centric rather than focusing on the needs of your organization, you are more likely to find a connection and a meaningful one. And we know from several of the other data points that personal connection and meaningfulness are critical to sustaining a donor and indeed acquiring new ones. So yes, that is always a risk. That's why we're seeing increasing collaboration on both the part of donors who come together in giving circles and other collaboratives to give to causes they care about. We're also seeing collaboration on the part of similarly situated or similarly oriented nonprofits who recognize the efficiencies of sharing resources in this time and also perhaps of accomplishing their mission more readily to the extent that their missions overlap by engaging in joint efforts. So those are a couple of ways by which to manage that potential for fatigue. But I think really differentiating your message, listening to the needs of the donor alongside the needs of your own organization will really put you in good stead.
Claire Costello is the National Foundation Executive for Philanthropic Management at Bank of America Merrill Lynch. She was in Fayetteville last week to speak to the University of Arkansas Foundation Board. She happened to be here the day the 2010 Bank of America Merrill Lynch Study of High Net Worth Philanthropy Report was released nationwide. There is more from our conversation online and a link to the full report at OzarksAtLarge.com. Local support for Ozarks at Large comes from Theater Squared, continuing its fifth anniversary celebration with every Christmas story ever told, and then some, beginning Friday, December 10th and running through the 26th at Walton Arts Center's Nadine Baum Studios. Three actors rebel and set out to perform every Christmas story ever told, from Frosty to the Grinch, Charlie Brown to George Bailey. Tickets and more information available at theater2.org. or 571-2728. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, Bentonville. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks for listening.